We're in 1 Kings chapter 15, looking at what this book tells us about King Asa of Judah, who is the now third king of the divided kingdom of Judah after Solomon. His great-grandfather died, then the kingdom was divided. And so Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, is still the king in the north, although as we saw in his second year of Asa, Jeroboam dies and then his son Nadab becomes king. That's in verse 25 of this book, but we read through verse 24 and we covered down through verse 21. We don't have a lot of information about Asa in here. He gives us a little bit of a sketch. And primarily the details that we do have in this in these few verses of 1 Kings 15 about Asa is as it relates to the to Baasha, who was the king of Israel. He was basically the general or the chief military leader under Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. When Jeroboam died and his son Nadab became king, then Baasha murdered him and all of the family of Jeroboam, which was God's promise and prophecy of destruction on the house of Jeroboam. Baasha is the one that carried it out and then became king. And then his house was going to get wiped out after his death and his son became king. The same thing was going to happen to his family. We'll get to read about that in, later on in this chapter, Lord willing. But the part about Asa is really focusing on that one primary event that involved both Asa and Baasha. But the first part of what we're told about in 1 Kings 15 of Asa is about the fact that he walked in the steps of David. He did what was right in the sight of the Lord in verse 11. And then it told us how he removed the idols and the sodomites from Judah that had come in, that chapter 14 had told us had come into Judah under Rehoboam, Asa's grandfather, and then that continued under Asa's father, Abijam. And so his father wasn't righteous and his own mother wasn't righteous, as Asa had to remove her from being queen because she followed idols. So when he got rid of the idolatry and the sodomites and was trying to clean up the land and remove the wickedness from it, that included putting his own mother out from being queen. But then it told us about what happened between Asa and Baasha, in that Baasha decided to build a defense city in Ramah, just across the border from Asa's territory. One of the things that we noted, we were not told a lot about Abijam, Asa's father, and his reign, other than that his father was wicked. And the only detail other than that general description was what we had in 2 Chronicles chapter 13. That chapter was about Abijam and focused on one of the battles between Abijam and Jeroboam the son of Nebat, which took place in the region of Samaria in the middle of Israel. And so there was obviously a pretty wide open door for Judah to be able to come up into Israel's territory. And of course, if Israel were stronger, the reverse would have been true. But at this particular time, who did God favor between Judah and Israel? He had favored Judah because of the wickedness of Jeroboam and the fact that he and all the people of his kingdom had forsaken the Lord. Now, the spiritual situation in Judah declined after Rehoboam's first 3 years. However, there were still some righteous ones there in Judah. And that's the only place where there were any of the Lord's faithful children at this point in time. Although they had dwindled in number, But Asa was one of those, in spite of his parents, in spite of what was going on in the land at that time. But God gave Judah more favor than Israel, than the northern kingdom. And so even though Abijam wasn't righteous, Abijam was boasting the fact that they had the Lord's temple and the sacrifice going on, the Lord's priest, which that was true, but Abijam wasn't following the Lord himself, so it didn't help him, but he brought that up when he was contending with Jeroboam. But it showed why, in that situation, God gave victory to Judah. But it's not hard to see why Baasha then was thinking from a strategic standpoint why it would be a good thing to see about blocking Judah and her kings from being able to come up into his territory. So he built Ramah to try to make it a strong city that would prevent that. So Asa was confronted with that problem. So not only would that block him from going there, but that would be that was an immediate threat to them, because if that city is strong, then that could be easily a staging point for an invasion from Israel into his territory. So that was a pretty much an untenable situation for Asa and the people of Judah. So he had a problem. Baasha presented him with a great problem there, with his attempt to fortify Ramah. So what did he do about it? And the real lesson from that we focused on last week, and that was the situation we were looking at from down to verse 21. What did he do about it? Well, he went and took some of that remaining gold and from the temple. Some of that had already been taken out when Rehoboam, when Shishak, the king of Egypt, had invaded Judah, as God used that to punish Rehoboam when he departed from the Lord. But then Rehoboam essentially paid him off with some of that gold, the gold targets and shields from the temple that Solomon had made. Well, some of the remainder of that Asa used and gave to the king of Syria, Ben-Hadad, and to buy his allegiance, because he had been an ally of the king of Israel. So he had to buy his allegiance to break his league with the king of Israel, then to join with him against the king of Israel. And he took it, and Ben-Hadad then invaded the north of Israel. And so Baasha had to go and leave off from his work at Ramah to go tend to the back door that just got invaded from the Syrians. So he was, from his standpoint, Baasha was thinking he was in a pretty secure position because he had an ally with that strong nation, Syria, that was on his north flank. And so he felt freed up then to concentrate his efforts and resources against Judah. Well, that didn't work out, and so he had to go defend himself against the Syrians, and then left off Ramah, and so that ended that. So the next thing we read about is that when Baasha left that off, then Asa went up there with his people and broke down and destroyed whatever Baasha had built there. In fact, let's go ahead and, I know we read that last time, but let's go ahead and read 22 through 24, which is the last three verses of what we're told about Asa here in 1 Kings. So 1 Kings chapter 15, verses 22 through 24. Let's see, Brother Tom, can you read that for us, please?
Then King Asa made a proclamation throughout all Judea. None was exempted, and they took away the stones of Ramah and the timber thereof, wherewith Baasha had built it, and King Asa built with them Geba, of Benjamin, and Mizpah. The rest of all the acts of Asa and all his might, and all that he did, and the cities which he built, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? Nevertheless, in the time of his old age, he was diseased in his feet, and Asa slept with his fathers, and was buried with his fathers in the city of David, his father. Jehoshaphat, his son, reigned in his stead.
All right, so, and this is kind of interesting. This is obviously not what Baasha intended when he brought those materials down there to build up Ramah, but then when he had to go unexpectedly fight off the Syrians that had been his ally, that now Asa had bought off, and so Ben-Hadad invaded the north of Israel, so Baasha had to go tend to that, so then he had to leave off what he would had his building there in Ramah, which meant there's nobody there to guard that, including all those materials, the stone and timber and all of that. So Asa made everybody, all the able-bodied people, clearly, he made that proclamation. None was exempted. Everybody had to go up there, so that we can see that was a mass effort and very quick. But what did they do? They took all that stuff that from and then put it in. Where did he put it? And what did he do with it? He built up Geba of Benjamin and Mizpah. Well, in his territory, back to a crude map of Israel. All right. So then roughly we have this division point in the kingdoms. So, as far as Judah's territory, Benjamin, it's the smallest territory there. I mean, Judah was huge. But Benjamin, that territory was that in that region, that border region with Israel, north of Benjamin was, Jeroboam, the son of Nebat's kingdom, and then by this time, Baasha. So here, Ramah would have been just to the north of that. Well, Benjamin is essentially that buffer zone, that border area. So what did he do? I mean, instead of that being a stronghold on the Israel side, now it becomes a stronghold on the Judah side in the Benjamin's territory. So he uses Baasha's materials that he was trying to build a stronghold with in Ramah, and then he builds a stronghold with his materials in Benjamin, or two of them. So clearly that was not what Baasha had in mind. So in essence, he ended up donating a lot of material to make his situation worse. And from that standpoint, he ended up himself kind of building up the strong points for his rival on the border instead of for him. That was not the way he was anticipating that go. All right, so the outcome for Asa there was exactly what he couldn't have asked for a better outcome from that situation. And who clearly made that happen? Who favored that and delivered that outcome? I mean, that was from the Lord. That was clearly from the Lord. It could be easy to look at the outcome there and the fact that the Lord favored Asa and delivered that outcome for him that was good. It could be easy to see that and then conclude, well, Asa handled that just right. Well, that's really not the case. I mean, the Lord gave him a desired outcome there, really, in spite of the way he handled it. Because he ended up donating that gold. Because there's no way of asking it. Is that the only way the Lord could have delivered that outcome? By giving the gold from the temple to a wicked man, Ben-Hadad? Was it God's? And I mean, this was from God's own temple. Was it God's will for what was his to be given into the hands of a wicked man, Ben-Hadad? I mean, where would he have put that stuff? We're not told specifically, but any chance that could have been put somewhere? I mean, for Ben-Hadad's idol worshiping? I mean, that's a very easy, that's a likely result from that. But in any event, it was what belonged to the Lord, and it was now in the hands of a wicked man, the Syrian. That's not what God would have desired with his things, Brother Tom.
I'll just go back to verse 14. But the high places were not removed. Nevertheless, Asa's heart was perfect with the Lord all his days.
Yes.
All his days.
And that's true. But in spite of that, he was not, in his mind, and this is why this is such an important lesson, in his mind, he was not breaking a commandment of God. He was not doing something personally evil with those things. He was seeking a good outcome. The last thing that we're told about Asa is going to be another example of this. The last thing it says is he died and was buried. But before that, what's the piece of information it gives about Asa that before he tells us how he died? At the late stage in his life, he had a problem, a health problem. He was diseased in his feet. Now, we're not told any more about that here, but what we are going to be told about in 2 Chronicles is that in that situation, he was seeking to the physicians and was not asking the Lord. And I know that for me, that's we'll get to that. That's it's not an anti-doctor scripture, but when it comes to, we always have to be seeking, we need to ask the Lord for everything. We remember Joshua. You remember a couple of instances where Joshua forgot that lesson? In Joshua chapter 9, when the people of Gibeon came and they were in disguise and were to deceive them, to make a covenant with them. We came from this, we heard of you and your God, and we came from this long country on a faraway journey to join ourselves and make a league with you. And it tells us that that Joshua and the elders of Israel didn't ask counsel of the Lord there. Well, the Lord knew who they were and where they were from. And if Asa had gone, I mean, if Joshua had gone to the Lord and said, should I make a league with these people? Who are these people and should I join with them? Would the Lord have told him? Well, that there's a reason he makes the point that he didn't ask counsel of the Lord, so the Lord didn't tell him. And so he made the league with and believed them, and they deceived him, and so then he joined with them. Then he found out after the fact, but he was stuck to the agreement. But that was a case where Joshua was looking at a situation and did not ask counsel of the Lord. Well, that was the second time, major time that we're told about when he, and the last, but before that, when after defeating, conquering Jericho, in Joshua chapter 7, they went to Ai and battle against Ai, which was a small city, and they went and lost the battle because Achan had taken of the accursed things of Jericho and had put it under his tent, and so it caused the Lord not to bless the nation, because God had forewarned them if anybody did that, it would cause trouble for the whole camp of Israel. So they had that sin in the camp. Well, if Joshua had asked the Lord before going and fighting the battle against Ai, should we go up against Ai? How should we go up? And who always did that? David. There was one situation in his life when he failed in that. So we have this lesson that comes up even with, I mean, when you talk about men like Joshua, David, and now here's a man, as Brother Tom points out, whose heart was perfect with the Lord all his days, but he, in this situation, clearly didn't ask the Lord, what is the way to do this? He looked for a solution and did it, stepped out and handled it. The Lord gave him a favorable outcome anyway. Later on with his feet, if he'd asked the Lord, heal my feet, I mean, there could have been a different, and the Lord could have used the doctors to help him with it, but in any event, Asa, there are a couple times where he makes this mistake. So when we see people like Joshua or David, Asa, and ones like that didn't think about this, even in one or two situations in their lives, where they weren't thinking about, okay, asking the Lord, help me, Lord. If that could happen to them, what could happen to us? Brother Tom?
It's really, it's a clear example of taking the Father for granted.
Yeah.
You know, it's obviously, if their hearts are always right, they've always known God and they've always believed. But we have those opportunities, and sometimes we mess up.
Yes. And the reminder is for we have to try to be aware of that. That's the teaching point here, that in every situation in our lives, that we don't take a step without the Lord at any time. I mean, because it can happen once or two times in our lives, and then we're just kind of doing things. I've kicked myself a number of times when I didn't pray about something like or as much as I should have, and then realized that, well, I should have done that more. I don't think I'm alone in that, but that's the point of this, is for us to think about that and make sure that we're looking at every situation and that we don't end up having anything come up where we just go off on our own, not with bad intentions, but just go off on our own in that particular moment in time and not think about, okay, well, what is the best way to handle this and ask the Lord to help us in that? Because if that could happen to Joshua or Asa, sure can happen to me, and it could happen to you too. And so that's what we see these situations. It reminds us of that. So here was a good man, but in the situation, he looked at a solution and took this avenue, but the Lord could have provided a better way blessed him with the same outcome, but it could have been without that gold going to Syria, to Ben-Hadad, just like later on with his feet. And he doesn't get the blessing. The Lord this time had blessed him in spite of it. He didn't with his feet later, that we'll see. So that's a real couple of these points in Asa's life are real good teaching cases for us to think about on a not just a daily basis, but a moment-to-moment basis, that we don't let something like this come up and we trying to handle a situation that comes up in our lives, maybe with the best of intentions, but we don't think about, well, is this really the best way to handle this? What does the Lord say about that? And consider all the scriptures. Be very diligent and fervent in our prayers to God for His blessings and His guidance in it, and for His help. I mean, that's what we need to do. So when you have some really strong examples of good people in God's Word that made that mistake, it's real important for us to pay close attention to that, because we could do the same thing very easily. All right, so the Lord blessed him anyway, and so he ended up with some strong points in his own land for that. But there's so much more about the life of Asa and that we can learn from. But we won't do so from 1 Kings. That's it, as far as what's in 1 Kings about him. So now we need to go to the book of 2 Chronicles, to chapter 14. Where now we have three chapters in this book about Asa. Chapters 14, 15, and 16. So if you were curious and wanted to learn more about Asa, or desired to have more information about him, that was a very righteous man, well, here we go. We got it. 2 Chronicles chapter 14, if we can go over there. Let's read verses 1 through 5. 2 Chronicles 14, 1 through 5. Brother Allen, can you read that for us, please?
So Elijah sat with his fathers, and they buried him in the city of David. And Asa, his son, lay in his death. In the days, the land was quiet 10 years. And Asa did that which was good and right in the eyes of the Lord his God. And he took away the old and strange gods and the high places, and drank down the images, and cut down the groves. He commanded Judah to seek the Lord God of their fathers, and to do the law and the commandment. Also he took away out of all cities of Judah the high places and the images, and the kingdom was quiet before him.
Okay, and there's going to be much more emphasis on that last point of verse 5 that will continue on beyond that, that we'll get to look at as the Lord blesses him with some quiet, with some peace, and then he's going to use that to strengthen himself. The Lord's going to bless him with that. We read part of that, at least that one instance, how that happened. But verse 1 tells us about Abijah and his death. This is Asa's father, and he was buried in the city of David. And then Abijah's son reigned in his stead, which is Asa. And it says, in his days, the land was quiet 10 years. So God blessed Asa with 10 years, 10 years of quiet. Sometimes might have 10 minutes. But of course, we're talking about from this standpoint, quiet from the trouble of enemies, of having threats against the kingdom, either from his neighbor to the north, Israel, or from the other neighbors around him. So he was blessed with this period of peace in his time. So that was something that God obviously gave to him. And there's a reason why. And it tells us in verse 2. And Asa did that which was good and right in the eyes of the Lord his God. And then it tells us the things that much like the summary we saw in chapter 15 of 1 Kings about him, about how he took away the altars of the strange gods in the high places and broke down the images and cut down the groves. So he took action himself, which he was responsible for. He took action to remove the idols from Israel. He didn't just say, this is bad. Hey, everybody, don't do that anymore. Now, what did he say anything to the people? Well, yes. What did he say in verse 4? It says, he commanded Judah to seek the Lord God of their fathers and to do the law and the commandment. And then it says he took away from the cities of Judah the high places and images, and the kingdom was quiet before him. So the Lord blessed him. That quiet came from God. Could it come from anywhere else? No. But it came from God, and it came from God as a blessing directly as a result of what Asa did when he became king, in that he was seeking God and following the Lord, and he told the people to do the same. He instructed his subjects to follow God and keep his commandments. And then he also took action against wickedness because he had the authority to do so. So he didn't just talk, he did. He did both, which was necessary. Now we have examples of those who did neither or went the other way, which was his predecessors, his immediate predecessors. We're going to see a parallel with Asa and his grandfather, Rehoboam, with what happened with Rehoboam the first 3 years of his reign when he was following the Lord. It's interesting to see that. Now, Rehoboam, as we were told in chapter 12, that he did not prepare his heart to seek the Lord. And so he did evil as a result. He departed from God. But he had 3 years where the Lord blessed him, and he was able to build up his defenses. And he had 3 years of quiet, but then he blew it. I mean, that 3 years would have, how much would that have ended right then if he had continued on with his seeking or following the Lord at that time? The Lord would have continued to bless him, but he was the reason that lasted only 3 years, because then he departed from the Lord, and then the Lord's peace that he blessed him with also departed. But Asa is different. Asa did prepare his heart to seek the Lord, and so he didn't just have 3 good years and then turn away from God. He continued, again, as Brother Tom reminded us from that statement in 1 Kings 15, all of his days he followed the Lord. So he understood these blessings were from God, and he didn't forsake the Lord, and the blessings didn't go away. So God continued to provide him with this peace in his kingdom for a long time. So the kingdom was quiet before him, but we should be able to see the direct connection between God providing that blessing to Asa and Asa's decision to do the Lord's will and then to instruct his people to do so, and then also to take the action to remove the wickedness from the land. Now we can go back and remember Eli, who was high priest of Israel in the end of the time of the judges, late in that time, because the last judge of Israel was Samuel the prophet, and Samuel was actually his very first prophecy in 1 Samuel chapter 3 when he was young, was when he was in the tabernacle with Eli as his mother Hannah had made a vow to, if the Lord would give her a son, that she would give him to the Lord. And the Lord heard her prayer, and she was given Samuel. And so when he was weaned, then she took him there to the tabernacle, and he grew up there serving the Lord. He was a Levite, but he was there to serve and assist the high priest. And so he was there. That was how he grew up. And his mother would come and visit him, but that's what she vowed to the Lord, and she kept it. But God then, of course, made Samuel into a great prophet and also the judge of Israel. But his first prophecy was against Eli, the high priest, the one that he was serving there. And would that not be difficult to have to tell him when you're young? And he's the high priest of Israel, and you're serving him, and then you have to go tell him something that the Lord says against him and that he's done wrong. Well, it wasn't the first time that Eli had been told that, but God was displeased with Eli because he said, you did not restrain your sons. Now, you can look in 1 Samuel chapter 2, and you can read when about Hophni and Phinehas, his wicked sons who were priests. The things they did there were awful. But Eli didn't participate in it. He didn't do the evil. And then he told his sons, these things that you do are not good. And so he did rebuke them for their evil. But what did he do about it? He didn't do anything about it. He had authority to do something about it. He said words to them. They didn't listen. They didn't change. And then he didn't do anything. He let it go on. And so by the lack of action there, I mean, the Lord condemned him for that and told him, you will not, I'm going to remove, the high priesthood is going to be removed from you, from your family, and I'm going to give it to a man who's faithful. Well, that faithfulness included not just refusing to participate in other people's evil, not just saying something. I mean, those are two necessary things. I mean, it's, if you participate in other people's evil, well, that's certainly, then you become a part of it. If you don't say it, if you don't participate but don't say anything, I mean, that's not going as far as we need to go. But what if you don't participate? What if you say something but you don't do anything and you have authority to do something? That's not acceptable. This came up, by the way, in Revelation chapter 2, if we can go over there. This is part of the Lord's rebuke of the church at Thyatira. In Revelation chapter 2, verses 18 through 20, and it's interesting to see the real point of rebuke here for the church. Revelation 2, 18 through 20. Brother Aaron.
Outstanding, you got a few things against me.
because you what? What's that word in verse 20 that starts with an S? What does that mean? What does that word mean? We don't... None of my children ever have ever come up to me and asked, Daddy, would you suffer me to... We don't use that word in our modern English. I think we all know what it means. We think of suffer, of course, means when you're something bad's happening to you. This is the other meaning of the word. When if you're suffering something, what is that? What's the word we use? Allow. That's exactly what the word means. So here in Revelation 2:20, what was he rebuking the church at Thyatira for? You allow it. Did the church have authority to put a stop to that false doctrine, that immorality that was going on in their midst? Same thing in 1 Corinthians 5 that he rebuked them, the church at Corinth for. They had fornication going on in the church. What were they doing about it? They weren't doing anything about it. And he commanded them to do something about it, which they listened, they did something then. But that was the rebuke there in Revelation 2 verse 20 for the church. You are allowing this to go on there. They had authority to put a stop to that. I mean, we're the church here at North Columbia. Do we have any control over what's taught and done here? Absolutely we do. We are responsible for God, before God, for that. What about in our own families? I know today's called Father's Day. Well, those of us who are fathers, where does the buck stop, as the saying goes? I mean, who has the authority in our families? Who's responsible for what goes on in our house? We can't be like Adam and say, well, it's the woman you gave me, or it's these children you gave. We have, when you have authority, the Lord's authority comes from God. And when we have it, we better use that authority in righteousness and use it to do what's right. And we can't allow things to go on that are evil. Now, does that mean, can we control what other people do in a sense? Can we make somebody else repent, or can we make somebody else believe? No. We can't force somebody on the inside to be right. But we do have control over what is done when we have authority. So, if something wicked is being done here in North Columbia, if something false is being taught, that's our fault if we allow it. So if something comes out, you can look at Galatians 2, what Paul said about when those false teachers cropped up where he was, and he said he did not put up with it for even an hour. Well, that was the Apostle Paul. He put a stop to it. He didn't allow it to go on. I mean, he had authority as an apostle, but that was it. When that came up, it didn't happen again. So I remember many years ago over in country Tennessee, but there's a little congregation. It's actually the congregation where Cindy Johnson, we think everybody here knows Cindy and Brett's wife, and but it's the area that her family, where they were from, where all of her welfare people were. But she had still had a lot of relatives over in that area back. This is in the early 90s. But that was a little country congregation. They were very strong in their faith. The elders, they had a gospel meeting. Somebody came in and was teaching error. And the elders signaled each other, and one of them got up right when the stuff was coming out, and they signaled. He got up and said, "We're going to be singing number whatever, whatever," and led them in a song right there. Stopped and said, the other elder went and got the guy, took him to the back room where the back door was, and ushered him out and sent him on his way. That was that. That's how they handled that there, but. They told us about that, but anyway, because they were making a point. They were going to make, if they were going to be involved in our work over in India, which is what we were asking them to help, they were determined they were going to be a part of it had to be done right the Lord's way, and the truth had to be taught. But they were serious about it. And when they've been in a position, I mean, they didn't just sit there and allow false teaching to go on from the pulpit that they were responsible for. They stopped it right then and there. But what's the right thing to do? We got to take action. And if the Lord gives us, puts us in a position of authority. Well, Asa is a very good example of that. We already saw it in what we were told in 1 Kings 15. He took action even against his own mother. So if he was willing not just to say something, but to do something, even when it required, when his own mother's worshiping an idol, if there was going to be someone where he could turn a blind eye to or just say, Mom, make sure you just do that in private. That's not what he did. It wasn't right, and he was king, and he was not going to allow that. He was not going to allow idolatry in his land, in his kingdom, even when it was his own mother. And so when she was insistent upon doing that, out she went. So it'd be harder to find a stronger example of somebody who was going to stand up and take action, not just to sit idly by and let something go on. He did not allow it. Asa didn't. So he took action. He told the people, follow the Lord. Keep his commandments. He strove to do that himself. And then he took every action he could to get wickedness out of his kingdom. So it tells us those details of the things that, he did as part of that, what was good and right in the eyes of the Lord his God. And because he did that, that's the reason why the Lord gave him quiet for those 10 years. And the land was quiet before him. But the Lord, it makes the point in sequence there down to verse 5 here in 2 Chronicles 14, that the Lord's blessing of quiet in his kingdom came after he did those things that first were told about when he became king. So he didn't wait around. Remind us of his great-grandfather David. I mean, as soon as David became king, well, now all of a sudden he had authority. Was the city of Jebus, was that David's problem and responsibility before he was had authority as king over all the tribes of Israel? It wasn't his tribe. He was from the tribe of Judah, and Saul was of Benjamin, but he was king before him. Did David have authority to do something about the Jebusites being in that city that was a city that God by lot had given to Benjamin as part of their inheritance? But they had done nothing about the Jebusites occupying that city. So what could David do about that before he was king of Israel? Nothing. I mean, that was not, he didn't have authority to do something about that. But as soon as he became king, whose responsibility was it? Now it's his problem. And if the Jebusites are allowed to go on, still dwell there in Jerusalem, then who's got to answer for that? Then David's going to have to answer for that. So what was the first thing David did when he became king? He went and got the Jebusites out of Jerusalem. He went and fought that, took the city. Well, then he made it the city of David, which is remained the capital of Israel for the rest of its time. But that's what David did. So, I mean, the moment David became king, he took the responsibility and the authority that God gave him, and he exercised that in righteousness, and he took action. He did something there. And of course, then there had been the Ark of the Covenant had been, the tabernacle had been gone, going back all the way to the time when Eli was high priest. So throughout Saul's reign, the Ark of the Covenant was down there in Kirjath-Jearim, and there was no tabernacle. And so David took Jerusalem. The very next thing he does is to go to arrange to have the Ark of the Covenant brought up there. So he was going to try to rectify that problem, that spiritual problem in Israel. I know we went over all of that when we studied David's life, but it's just a reminder again of that. When we had a man after God's own heart, everything he did, he took action. By the way, if you want somebody, you can scarcely find a better example of somebody where the Lord emphasizes over and over again in their lives about how he would seek the Lord's counsel in everything before he would do it. So we were on that point, I know, a little while ago, but since we're bringing up David again, that was David's pattern as it should be our pattern. Asa goofed a couple of times in that, but we need to make sure we don't. But anyway, David used that authority he had as king, and he took action and just continued to do that. Well, Asa does that. Lord blesses him. Now in verse 6, here in chapter 14, he's going to build up those fenced cities in Judah, and there's no war there. And it's going to tell us about some more of the details of how he organized and strengthened his kingdom. But we're out of time this morning for that. So, Lord willing, next week we'll pick it up in verse 6 of chapter 14 and see what Asa does with the blessing of that quiet the Lord gives him. Another lesson, because, I mean, we do something right, the Lord blesses us for. Well, how do we use the blessings God gives us? We need to use those blessings in turn to, in a good way, in our service to God, and so that that will continue on, which is what Asa will do. So, Lord willing, we will pick up there next time. Let's see. Brother Peter, would you lead us in prayer as we close?